and welcome to episode 124 of Not a Real Job, a comedy advice podcast about marketing and business and jokes and goofs and tech and other stuff. I'm your host, Chris Van Patten. As of course, with me as always, my esteemed co-host, Mr. Joel Kelly. But not only are we not a real job, I think our longtime listeners know that we're multiple podcasts. We're a podcast with an identity crisis, perhaps. So in addition to being not a real job, we are the Curse of Joke Island, the comedy review show of The Curse of Oak Island, one of the great television shows. But what you might not know is that we're also two other shows. Of course, The Great British Bake Talk, the chat show about everything Great British Bake Off. And we're also Terrace Grouse, where we grumble a bit about the joyful show that is Terrace House. Joel, have you caught up on all the shows this week?
Well, okay. So yes and no. Uh-huh. And I'll start with the no portion of it.
Okay.
I've never seen an episode of Great British Bake Off or Terrace House.
Okay.
And I am not up to date with The Curse of Oak Island. On the yes front,
uh-huh,
I agree that those are all pretty good jokes.
Well, thank you.
The Curse of Joke Island is that was the peak. Yeah, a masterpiece for sure.
And what's great about that is that it could also be the name of the show itself.
Yeah, are you excited to finally visit?
Oh man, Joel, I haven't thought about anything else. You got your trowel.
You got your pith helmet. You got your reaching for every vine. You've got your inclination to swing at every pitch.
You know it, Joel. I've got my Templar history book.
Holy shit.
I'm very excited.
Where others might see a series of intersecting lines, you see a Templar cross every time.
Mm-hmm. Every time, all the time.
Interestingly enough, the tree outside my house that I can see from this my office window, two branches intersect at near right angles to each other.
Now, do you think that's where the 90-foot stone is buried underneath that tree?
We gotta dig up anyway. It's up to the city, but we have a very old pipe that goes, you know, from our house into the sewage. And there's a tree root that grows into it. We discovered this when we had a man put a camera down it before we bought the house, and he provided us with a DVD. I've never actually looked at the footage, but all that to say, we got to dig up this yard at some point anyway.
Yeah, I think we go
90 feet down instead of, I'm guessing, 6 to 7 feet. How deep do you think a pipe is in your front yard?
At least
under the soil, or
probably under the bodies. Probably much deeper than that. Definitely under the bodies. Joel, there's so much greatness in the television world right now. I'm very excited about it. Great British Bake Off, you have not watched it. That is your fault. You are to blame for that. Uh-huh. It's delightful.
Is it?
It's absolutely delightful. It's just so nice and lovely, and you get swept up in the lack of drama, just the niceness.
So yeah, the stakes feel too low to me.
That's what's so great about it, Joel. That's what makes it good. And of course, Terrace House. I mean, whoo boy, if you had told me a year ago that a Japanese reality show produced by Netflix was going to be something that I would be addicted to, I would have said, well, yes, actually, you're right. That probably does sound like something I would do. But whoo boy, so good. You all need to check it out. It's also nice. It's also addictive. And for the past week and a half, 2 weeks, that's pretty much all I've done.
I was excited.
Yeah,
I was excited to be able to say that I couldn't watch it in Canada, but unfortunately it looks like I can. So I really don't have any excuse here.
Terrace House?
Yeah.
No, dude, it's a Netflix original series now.
Yeah.
So that means it's everywhere.
Oddly, that hasn't turned up in my recommendations yet.
Well, I mean, that's on you.
That's a personal problem. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I am not exaggerating when I say the three things that have kept me busy for the past week are The Great British Bake Off, Terrace House, and Dragon Age, which is a Vidya game that I am now playing.
Okay, well, we're going to get to that in a second. I just first want to apologize to Steve when he has to edit this audio. My levels are going to be all over the map. I kind of forgot how to podcast, and I've been moving around quite a bit here.
Yeah, it's a little cattywampus.
It's what?
It's a word, cattywampus. You can look it up.
Oh, I'm confident it's a word. I just...
It means crooked, lopsided, askew, helter-skelter, etc. Hmm. Yeah. Hmm. Well.
Have that one in the chamber for a while, I bet.
Oh, I clicked on the Urban Dictionary definition, and here in the list, there is an alphabetical list of words. Another one of the words I just want to point out is catulence, smelly, audible kitten farts. So,
Merriam-Webster wants to direct us to other words like bumfuzzle.
Thank God for Merriam-Webster.
Bumfuzzle, gardy-loo, and more. 10 funny sounding and interesting words. So this is the show, right? Because
we're just bouncing back and forth between Gardy Lou conversation topics.
It's used. It appears to be a UK thing. It's a Scottish thing. As a warning cry, when it was customary to throw slops from windows into the streets.
Cool. You don't remember that from Braveheart?
That's upsetting. No. Terra Diddle. That's pretentious nonsense.
Well, anyway, so before we get,
Billingsgate. I'm only at 5 out of 10 on this list. Sure. So.
This will be the rest of the show, but I would like to say, because you're probably hearing me, I'm a sniffly boy this week.
Yeah.
I'm a little sick, which is why I haven't done anything but Netflix and video games for the past week. So,
So tell me about you're playing Dragon Age. Which one?
Inquisition, the latest one.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I got 10 or 12 hours.
For.
Yeah, I got about 10 or 12 hours into that game before I somehow got distracted about something else, and now I want to go back to it and start over, but it just feels like such an investment, because there's so many other video games, Christopher.
Joel, I have, again, a week, so since Monday, so by the time this comes out, it'll be like 10 days, but in the span of time that I've been playing, I have logged nearly 30 hours.
Yeah.
Which is roughly like 5 hours a day of playing this game, so I'm not proud of that.
Did you enjoy it?
Oh, I've enjoyed it immensely.
How often would you say you really spend a bunch of time in bulk only thinking about your own entertainment?
Actually, very little, which is why this past week has been really weird.
So I think you're due. I think you're okay.
Yeah, but still, like, when I think about all the books that I could have been reading in the past week, I get very sad. So I try not to think about that very much.
Those books will still be there.
Yeah, they will.
I've played, about 30 hours of Horizon Zero 4 in the last 2 weeks-ish, so.
I'm interesting. Now, that's Horizon Zero what?
Zero Dawn. I said Zero 4 because I wanted to jump to the part where it's on the PlayStation 4, but my brain forgot that I had to finish the first part.
Right, so my roommate, Dana, who you know, has been playing that game for the past couple days here, and it's a very pretty game.
It is remarkable. It's astonishing. I spend a shocking amount of time of that game in the photo mode, just taking pretty photos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can understand. It's extraordinary. That.
Mass Effect comes out on Tuesday, so there's a lot. There's a lot to kind of
absolutely.
On the video game front. This is what people would. Do you have a clever pun name for our video game talk show?
I will need more time.
Okay. So those jokes at the beginning of the show, those just weren't
those have
off,
been
off the dome.
You've been no, those were those. Premeditated for at least 2 days.
Wow.
Not kidding. Which,
good thing you've been sick.
Yeah, exactly. This is what I'm
I
doing
would have
with
saved
my time.
Curse of Joke Island for the last one, though. That was definitely your...
It was the strongest.
That was the strongest.
You're not wrong.
I mean, I'm guessing that's the one that came to you first, and that's what inspired you to come up with other joke names.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it kind of felt that way to me.
Well... At least, I'm transparent, if nothing else.
Yeah.
So, Joel, what have you been up to? Give us an update on the Joel experience.
Uh-huh. Well, we'll probably... Yeah, I'm trying to think of, like, how much to talk about on this show, because there's a lot of stuff happening, and some of it kind of needs to be parsed out now. That's not what I meant.
Parceled out
over time, so... we won't get into too much in this show, but let's talk about the fact that I haven't traveled at all this year and how wild that is.
How does it feel? Because I can imagine it being sort of a bit of, good and bad.
Yeah. On the good side, it's, I feel okay most of the time, which is a marked improvement from feeling, you know, on the cusp of death all the time. So that's a pretty big change. But mostly it just, I don't know, it feels that sense of, you know, it's interesting, being on the road all the time makes time travel at kind of a blistering pace, but for some reason it feels inherently productive because there is so much that kind of goes into it. And, you know, seeing different parts of the world, even if it's a place you've been to before, it's, you know, it's interesting. So it feels productive in its own right. So being in one place all the time, that anxiety over kind of like what you were saying of there are books I could be reading right now, that feeling is strong and at times overwhelming of if I'm going to be in one place for all this time. And let's be clear, I've been in one place January, February, and now middle of March. 2.5 months is not, it shouldn't be an astonishingly long amount of time for one person to not have traveled. But over the past 4 years, 4.5 years, I was traveling a couple times a month. So it's exceptionally odd, but I'm always feeling now that I'm not as productive or as focused or as, I don't know, I'm not putting enough work into my future at all times.
Yeah. No, I completely understand that. My last real trip was with you in Toronto back in November. And before that, it had been May and June when I did the big round the world excursion. So it's the Toronto trip was, you know, that's a 90-minute flight. That's really nothing. Yeah. So it's been, you know, coming on a year since my last big trip, and I can definitely feel, you know, the sort of the same things that you're feeling, like, you know, what am I working toward, if anything, you know, lately this past week it's been, oh my God, nothing is being accomplished. This is a waste of time. Which can, you know, it, like you said, you know, I definitely deserve the time off, and you do as well, you know, but it's very easy to sort of beat ourselves up and feel like, yeah, like we're wasting time, like we're wasting cycles on nothing. Even though, you know, stuff is getting done and mental health is a big factor in that, but it's hard to kind of give that the weight that it deserves.
That's exactly it. I think part of it is because you and I are as honest with ourselves as I think we're capable of currently being, which is not to say fully honest with ourselves, but I think we feel especially guilty because, you know, we say we deserve this time off or we deserve X, but, you know, in the grand scheme of things, two white dudes, you know, we don't deserve more than we already have.
Sure. You know, yeah.
At any point. So I think there's that added element of guilt of, yeah, I need some time for my own mental health. I need some time to not be traveling or working or anything just so I can kind of collect my thoughts and try to become a better person. But at the same time, yeah, there is just that added level of guilt of, don't I already have enough? Can I, you know, can I also just work?
I kind of think of it a lot like this sort of thing. There's kind of, for me anyway, a gap between sort of the rational, calculated thought of, which is, I deserve this time off, or not even deserve it, but I need this time off. That clearly, if I'm able to sink 30 hours into a video game over the course of a week, that's saying that I don't have the mental bandwidth for something, you know, at a higher level, or I don't have the, honestly, just the physical energy, partly due to the sickness and everything, but you know, just kind of overall, if this is what my brain needs, then, you know, rationally, then that just must be what it needs, and I should accept that. But there is that gap between sort of the rational, calculated, removed thought, you know, you're seeing it removed from yourself, and then what we actually think and feel, or what we actually feel, really, what sort of intuitively, our brain tries to tell us.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's sort of like, how do you close that gap, right? And this is something I've not only about, but this, but a lot of things where, you know, even something where I'm looking back at past actions that I've done, which is, of course, a fraught territory, but, you know, maybe things that I wasn't so proud of that I can rationally, in sort of hindsight, look back and say, oh, right, like that was a bad thing. And I can see that removed from the situation from a 1,000-foot view. but how do you translate that sort of calculated perception into real intrinsic, you know, next time that situation comes along, how do you make it so you're sort of intuitively do the right thing? Because it's hard to rationally think in a lot of situations. You have to sort of trust your gut to make the right choice. But how can we train our gut, I guess, is the question.
And that's, I mean, that's been the biggest challenge of practical philosophy since it began. I mean, I'm personally, you know, more interested in Stoic philosophy, but I'm there are many more, whether it's Zen Buddhism or anything like that, that, you know, ancient philosophies that that are meant to have a practical bent to them. But the challenge is always, well, how do you, we can always tell when we did the wrong thing, or we can look back and tell ourselves that was the right thing. But how do we in that moment meter ourselves and do what we do, the things that in the future we'll look back and be happy we did them. And I think that's, for me, it's just trying to start every single day, rechecking the actions of the previous day and trying to put myself in the headspace of today. So, you know, I read some Stoic philosophy every morning, and before I go to bed, I try to have a quick kind of recap on the decisions, the things I said, and ideally, you know, you slowly make progress towards your impulses get better as you begin to practice. Sorry, I keep cutting you off.
It's fine. I'm kind of collecting my thoughts. It's fine. But I think something that's interesting about that, and something that I question a lot, especially these days in the world of, you know, I won't even get into that, but, you know, the state of the political world. I think what's interesting is that Stoicism, Buddhism, especially when you take it as philosophy rather than religion, which I do, the techniques that they teach you or that they promote, whether that's meditation or, you know, I don't think there's a concrete name for what Stoicism teaches, but the teachings there really ends up being about that the way forward is by detaching yourself or removing yourself from those situations in the moment. So basically, like, meditation is teaching you to be better about in the moment sort of stepping out. And I think Stoicism hints at the same thing, which is that to get better, you have to be less attached in situations, which in this climate in the world, I wonder, and maybe it's just a semantic thing, but I wonder if removing yourself and getting good at basically unengaging from a situation is necessarily the best way to, you know, ultimately what I'm trying to do is not sort of step back, but actually step forward. I'm trying to engage with things in a better way. When a lot of these philosophies are saying, actually, no, that's, you're doing it wrong. You have to step out. So I don't know what kind of loosely talking here. Does that make sense at all?
I can sense the, if we have any listeners left, the ones, who may subscribe to these philosophies jumping through their headphones to disagree with your premise.
Which is totally fair and valid,
but I totally get what you're saying. At least I think I do. I think where I would not necessarily disagree, but kind of try to lean in a different direction is I don't think it's about detachment, necessarily, or perhaps not negatively. I think personally, and where I lean on these philosophies is it's not about being removed from the moment necessarily. It's not about disengaging. It's about, you know, when you write a book or write a screenplay, you know, the idea is that you should write dialogue as if everyone had a moment to collect their thoughts. You know, that's what good dialogue is. It still feels, you know, punchy. It still feels natural, but everyone's just had an extra couple seconds to put their words together. And for me, what practicing Stoic philosophy does is attempt to, in each moment, because I've already thought about different types of circumstances or different types of situations or different types of interactions, that I have done the, or every day I'm doing the little bit of extra homework and prep work for as many possible situations as one can, so that in that moment, I've almost bought myself a little extra time to think, so that I'm not always reacting emotionally, because, you know, that's what we do when we don't have a rational thought to lean back on. Instead of withdrawing or saying you don't know or accepting another person's viewpoint because they've thought about it and you haven't, we tend to just react emotionally instead. So it's about avoiding those situations where the things we say or the actions we take are not fueled purely out of emotion. They can be emphasized by emotions. Our emotions might be correct and then backed up with logic. But in many cases, the only way we react or the only way that we interact with other people shouldn't be one of pure emotion, but one of, okay, if I look back on this in a couple of years, you know, what's the right decision here? What's the right thing to say? So that is detachment in some sense, but I think it's more about practice. It's more about each situation you enter into, not approaching them as if they're unique and that it was impossible to prepare for, and that we have to lean on, this makes me angry, so I'm going to react the way I do to things that upset me, or this person said something mean to me, so that I'm going to say something mean to them, versus, you know, if you've practiced it, if you thought about it, when someone says something mean to you, for me, I reach to, you know, Epictetus, who said, you know, for such a small price, I buy tranquility, in that, you know, not reacting, not getting upset is a way to buy yourself a moment of tranquility versus a moment of anger. And that's just kind of being prepped for that. It's odd, and it does feel like you're detached when you're kind of reaching for quotes or mantras or examples in every single interaction you have with people. But I guess if it gets to the right outcomes, it's okay. And to tie that back to our current political situation, I think for me, I think there's a pretty strong argument to be said. We'd be in a much better situation in the world if everyone behaved that way. And I don't think there's any clearer picture of how I consider morality as trying to act in such a way that if everyone acted this way, the world would be a better place. That is the full articulation of what I consider to be moral. So if we all kind of gave ourselves an extra moment to think, if we all kind of decided that emotions are useful, but they're dangerous as often as they're useful, because we are just mammals, because we're, you know, a couple seconds off the savanna of Africa in the grand scheme of things, maybe, having a bunch of apes in offices or having a bunch of apes ruling over other apes, maybe this is fraught, to say the least. Maybe if we all step back and try to think about things as compassionate, caring people, we'd be in a better situation. So if detachment is the word that gets, I guess personally, I'm not convinced that's necessarily worse than being directly engaged in every situation.
No, I think that is completely fair. I think it is ultimately sort of a semantic thing and how you kind of think of it. I think the problem that I have with this idea of detachment specifically is I think it suggests, or at least that word, I think the suggestion is that you are removing yourself, that you are pulling yourself out of it in sort of a, I am better than this, or simply that I don't need to deal with this. And I think that can be an easy trap to fall into, to think of it as, you know, if in the moment you're taking that extra moment to think about how you want to react to a situation, it could be very easy to sort of say, well, I'm just going to not engage being an appropriate response. And in many cases, that may be the appropriate response, but I also think it's very easy to let it become, you know, cowardly, I guess. Maybe that's probably too strong, but you get what I mean. Like the idea that in the moment, if your response is to just remove yourself, which I think sometimes that, you know, would be what would be taught, that's not necessarily the right way to go about it. So it's, for me, it's, I completely understand, and I think it's just kind of the way that you think about it. It's and the way that you respond in that moment. Like, what is your instinct? And if your instinct is to completely sort of remove yourself, if that extra moment you think and you say, well, I'm just going to not respond here. Like, that's not necessarily the best way to go either all of the time.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. Leah and I have come to, it makes me feel like such a bad person. So I think this is an interesting.
Well, you are. You are.
Yeah, well, that, well, I mean, there are 3 points I'm going to try to make in as pithy a manner as possible. And the major point is, when it gets back to detachment, I think for me, I personally, based on my upbringing, based on my parents, based on, you know, a number of things, I don't think intrinsically I am a good person or as good a person as I would want to be. So for me, when it gets back to detachment, I am constantly, I think it's right for someone like myself. For instance, I have an extremely, if I let my emotions rule myself, I would be either screaming or crying most of the time. I have incredible mood swings and a pretty bad temper if I let it get to me. I think that when I talk about my temper, most people who only know me kind of a little bit are shocked by that because they've never seen me angry about anything. That's because I try really, really hard to not do that. So for me, detachment is about metering the emotions that I have and that I am given to, and trying to think about them rationally. Sometimes anger is useful if I want to make a rational point in a more engaging way, for instance. Letting some emotion into it can be more persuasive or convincing, or can show your commitment to something, but I like to be able to use it versus it use me. On the other point, Leah and I have been given to watching fail videos on YouTube from time to time, like people making really extraordinarily bad decisions. And my thought is always like, what did you think was going to happen? And then of course Leah gets mad at me for saying that, but she's like, they didn't think about this. They saw a big bouncy ball and thought, hey, if I, you get someone to run into this ball while I'm holding on it, won't it be funny? And we'll kind of bounce off each other comically. And of course that never happens. One person goes flying into the wall or the ground and gets hurt and cries because no one thought for a goddamn second about what was going to happen. And I guess the point I'm trying to make is if a sense of detachment from the moment of this is a crazy thing, let's do this. If someone just for a second went, wait a second, what do I know about momentum and objects in motion and their propensity to continue in motion? You know, a lot of people wouldn't have as many concussions or broken arms as they might be. So again, to get back to detachment, I think it's not about removing yourself from the situation. It's removing yourself briefly from your instincts. Those instincts, whether it was fear of the dark that gave us religion, or, you know, these instincts that led us so far as mammals and as apes, are no longer as good now that we're operating in societies. When there were 100 of us in, you know, in a forest, things were a lot different than there being 7 billion of us interconnected. And I think we'd all be better, just like that person who decided to run into their friend at top speed, thinking somehow that would go okay. I think we'd all be better off if we just took a second and thought about how our actions interact with other people's actions. And maybe just because we feel an emotion, we don't have the right to express it. And that may be my biggest point about all of this, is that I think the world would be a lot better place if people understood that their emotions are things that they could simply feel and not need to tell the person next to them about that feeling or direct it at them, that that it's okay to be angry and not do anything about it. And it's okay to be sad and not tell everyone you're sad, that it's okay to feel things and just feel them yourself and to experience them yourself without directing them at the other apes around you who have their own extremely complex series of thoughts and feelings and emotions. So if that's detachment, I think I still land on the pro side of it.
No, I think that's completely fair. Yeah, I think it's really just how you approach
And I'm going to take a moment to fuck up the audio and pour some more coffee here. So
cool. Go for it. Well, I mean, I think that's probably as good a time as any to move into our next segment of the show, which is the Amazon reviews. How does that sound?
Cool. Works for me. Let me fire up my...
your Amazon machine.
My Amazon.ca.
So while you do that, I'll explain what this is. So every week that we record a show, we give a recommendation for a product that we've recently purchased. These are things that we've bought ourselves with our own money. No one paid us to do this. But you can pay us to do this, by which I mean if you buy through the links in the show notes, which are linked up to Amazon. You just click there, buy the thing, and we get a very small portion of the profits. I think it's like 0.5% or something like that. But you know what? Every bit adds up, helps us make the show, and we really appreciate it. Joel, do you have something for me?
You know, I was just thinking, based on this, there's a chance, it's a small chance, but there's a chance that someone who's listened to this episode isn't aware of let's all go with Stoic philosophy, because that's what I'm currently interested in. And might be looking for a bridge into that. So I am going to recommend let me just make sure I get the title and author correctly. I'm going to recommend a book called, it was the first book on Stoic philosophy that I read a number of years ago on a recommendation from my brother. It's called A Guide to the Good Life, The Ancient Art of Stoic Joy by William B. Irvine. And it is essentially, it's this professor who decides to kind of pour through the ancient Stoic writers and just pull out some of their practical guides for living a better life. I can say quite honestly and without hyperbole that that looking into Stoic philosophy changed my life and changed it for the better. I feel like I'm a better person and I enjoy more of my time here on this planet based on reading it. That is not to say that Stoic philosophy is the one for you. I think practical philosophy is something that a lot of people could spend more time on, whether that's your personal religion or your faith. And for those of us who are not religious in the traditional sense, that could be, you know, Zen Buddhism or Stoic philosophy or any number of those. Having something to lean back on. And like I said at the beginning, having a way to kind of practice for the interactions you're going to have with other people, and pre-considering what you think the correct way to interact with someone or to engage in a situation can be good for you. So that's what I'm going to recommend.
On a similar note, I've got two recommendations. This one's on a similar note. The other one's a wild card. I'm going to recommend any of the books by the author Stephen Batchelor. He is a British individual who went out, found Buddhism, was ordained as a monk. He trained with the, you know, the Dalai Lama, all that kind of stuff. Ultimately, disrobed, left Buddhism as a ordained sort of doctrine, religion kind of thing. And since then has kind of recontextualized Buddhism as a secular atheist experience. So he's someone who goes back to the original source material about Buddhism. And of course, there's a good degree of interpretation in this, but he sort of sees it as a lot of the religious aspects, things like reincarnation and all these different elements, were kind of tacked on to what was originally more of a philosophy. And that a lot of these things that were tacked on were really more results of movements and things that were happening around the Buddha at the time, or around the historical Buddha at the time that Buddhism was brought into being, and shouldn't necessarily be tied up with Buddhism itself. You know, you're looking at influence from Hinduism, from other smaller religions at the time, you know, just kind of got pulled along. So his argument is that you can really approach Buddhism as a philosophy rather than a doctrine, a religious doctrine. So in particular, I'm going to recommend After Buddhism, Rethinking the Dharma for a Secular Age. It's fantastic. Confession of a Buddhist Atheist is more of a biography about him and explains how he got there. And then Buddhism Without Beliefs, A Contemporary Guide to Awakening was kind of his original manifesto on this subject. They're all very good. I recommend all of them. Now, that said, my wild card recommendation is Flavacol for better tasting popcorn. You can buy it in a 35 ounce container on Amazon for under $8. Highly recommend it. This is literally the stuff that movie theaters put on their popcorn to make it taste so good. This is, it's salt with butter flavor that has been macerated into a tiny granular powder. So it sticks to everything, which means that you need like a quarter teaspoon of this. And you put it over your popcorn and it's going to be amazing. One teaspoon is more than your daily salt content, so just be careful. But it's amazing if you are addicted
and
to
this comes
popcorn.
In a little milk carton.
Yeah, this comes in a little milk carton. It's about 2 pints, a little
holy
over
holy shit.
Yeah, so you
sodium
got
is-
you buy one of these and it's going to last you for a lifetime basically. So yeah, highly recommend it. It's like crack. It's so good. And yeah, it's amazing.
This is like when I discovered that MSG was just a thing you could add to stuff. It's like, oh shit, everything tastes better with this.
Yeah, it's a total game changer. You can also, I haven't done this yet, but like if you make your own popcorn, if you don't do the microwave thing, which I've recently started making my own.
Oh, you're right. So it is just like macerated salt.
Yeah, exactly. But you can also get... so the secret for the oil that most movie theaters use is a butter flavored coconut oil. So mm-hmm. if you want like the full experience, if you're doing a stovetop thing, that's the oil that you want.
Yeah, I always found that interesting. Like when I was hardcore vegan, how much stuff that is buttered, like nominally buttered, is completely vegan.
Butter is had a no idea. Yeah, butter flavored coconut oil. The butter that they put in this Flavacol, it's all 100% vegan. Yeah. Maybe not every brand, but certainly the majority of what you're going to get.
Yeah, so, I'm definitely not making dietary recommendations here. Nobody wants that from me.
Yeah, but, no, absolutely. But yeah, this stuff is fantastic, and I recommend
it. Now,
how
do you make your popcorn?
So what I do is I get a little saucepan, or a bigger saucepan.
Yeah, you're already there. Good, excellent. But go on. Tell everyone the proper way to make popcorn.
Yeah, so the secret is you put in a little bit of oil, enough to coat the bottom of the pan. You put in 3 or 4 kernels, and the idea is that you wait for those kernels to pop. When they pop, you know it's the right temperature. You pull the pan off the oil, or you pull the pan off the burner, excuse me. You put in the rest of your kernels. You get out that Flavacol. You sprinkle it over the top of the kernels, only a quarter teaspoon or a half teaspoon if you're making a little more. Then you put it back on the burner, let it pop, and enjoy.
Yeah, so... the saucepan or pot or whatever, the stovetop method for popcorn is the best. And it's also, everyone, it's the fastest, too.
Oh, yeah.
It has the least amount of cleanup. Like, air poppers are fun. Everyone likes a good air popper. Everyone likes to burn their shit out of their hands by touching their air popper in the wrong place. Look, they're fun. We have an air popper. Great.
Yeah.
If you want to make good popcorn, like you're gonna watch a good movie and you're sitting down for like you want this to be nice, you gotta do the stovetop method. It's gonna change how you make popcorn. The richness of the flavor, that it brings out the flavor of popcorn, which you may not have even realized didn't just taste like styrofoam.
Yeah.
It's just way better. Your air pop popcorn comes out stale and steamy.
And just like bland,
just bland.
It's
exactly.
Like little cardboard pellets. It's terrible.
Yeah. So like I said, we have an air popper. Do it. It's fun. It makes a fun sound and it's cool to watch it all do the thing, but stovetop way better. And if you've been looking to change up your popcorn game at all, I highly recommend it. And like I said, it sounds like because you're using the stovetop that it's going to take a long time. It really doesn't. We're talking under 10 minutes from start to finish.
Yeah, with cleanup and everything.
Fast. Because you just have to rinse. You've oiled a pan and you're not letting anything burn to it. You just rinse it. Wipe it out. Put it back in your cupboard. Delightful. Do it. Flavacol. I am not going to buy this.
Maybe I'll put a little in a container and bring it up to you in May when I visit.
Yeah. Yeah, just to like, here's Stoic philosophy in action. If I crave something as badly as I am currently craving Flavacol, I know to close the tab and never look at it again.
I guess I need to get back to my practice. But anyway, I think that'll do it for us. What do you think? Anything we forgot, missed?
No, I think that's good. We've been talking for a lot longer than I thought. That was fun. I would just say we're gonna probably, I don't know, Chris, if you disagree, but I'm hoping that over the next couple months we'll get back onto a maybe twice a month schedule or something.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we've both got a little more time now. You're not traveling as much. I'm spending 30 hours a week playing video games, so we could definitely fit in a little more recording. I'd love to keep it up.
So if you have thoughts, suggestions, I mean, we still seem to have a couple people who listen to the show when it goes up. So, you know, tell us what you think. If you hated this episode, cause you don't want us to talk about this shit, just let us know. It's not gonna hurt our feelings as much as you might think.
Yeah. And I think also the fact that we're settling or we're sort of blowing up our usual things. So the past couple episodes have been pretty philosophy heavy. I think that kind of reflects a lot about what we're thinking about personally. But if that bores you, let us know. We may or may not, you know, take your comments into consideration, but we'll certainly take them into consideration. It's, you know, the action that we'll question on. But yeah, anyway,
one final recommendation before we go.
Sure, go for it.
We did bring up politics briefly. I just want to say, if you do, if you are currently interested in American politics, that you could be anywhere in the world and be currently interested in American politics, because we sure as shit all are. I highly recommend listening to two podcasts, Pod Save America and Pod Save the World. They're by former Obama speechwriters, aides, top policy experts. They now do like 4 episodes a week, I think, between those two shows, all about politics, the resistance, activism, and they have guests on, like the former ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, senior national security advisors during Obama's era. First of all, hearing the stark difference between how those administrations worked. Did you know Obama waited a year and a half before redecorating the Oval Office because he didn't want to offend anyone or make it seem like he was rushing Bush out of the office? Waited a year and a half.
Yeah.
Didn't get much credit for that. Anyway,
credit for a lot.
For a lot, exactly. I do recommend it for obviously these people are as worried as we all are, but they actually do have some actionable things that people can do. And they do have a longer sense of history than we all might in our current kind of panic. That can be good and bad because they also know how unprecedented so much of this is, but it can be a little reassuring to know that there are extremely smart people out there taking this problem extremely seriously. And yeah, it's kind of nice to hear, even if they're just as worried as we are, to hear some sane, smart people talk about it can be fun. So Pod Save America and Pod Save the World.
There you go. I haven't been listening to podcasts lately, so I've got nothing on that front.
You got the time.
Well, I will say, tell your friends about our show. I think especially now that we're going to start trying to do it more frequently, that maybe, you know, now we've got a little more time, maybe we'll start to try to make something of this again.
Yeah.
So we'd love for you to folks, share it.
We're going to do this anyway. It might as well be something you enjoy. So tell us. Yeah. Tell us what you'd like.
All right. Thanks everyone for listening. We will. Oh, links. NotARealJob.com, Twitter.com/Nargecast, at Chris Van Patten, at Joel Kelly on Twitter. All the links are on the website, too, so you can find everything. NotARealJob.com/gear has all of our gear picks for the years that we've been doing this. Holy crap, we've been doing this for years. And I think, if you want to sponsor, have a question, anything, info@NotARealJob.com is the way to get a hold of us.
Delightful.
Cool. Thanks everyone for listening, and we will talk to you very soon.
Goodbye.